Before we chat with Aaron today, we have to mention that this episode is brought to you by Searchlight Pictures and their new film, Empire of Light. Written and directed by Academy Award winner Sam Mendes and starring Olivia Colman, Michael Ward, Toby Jones, and Colin Firth.
Named one of Vanity Fair's 10 best films of the year, Mendes's drama features cinematography from Oscar winner Roger Deakins and an original score by Oscar winners Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. Now playing in select theaters, so get your tickets today. And now, on with the show.
I can see that you're definitely in love with films. I mean, you well, certainly it's your life, but it seems to be totally your life. Do you do anything outside of film, for instance?
What do you mean?
Hello and welcome to The Letterboxd Show, the podcast about the movies people love watching from Letterboxd, the social network for people who love watching movies. I'm Gemma, he is Slim, and each episode we're joined by a special guest to discuss their four favourite films. This week on the show, someone we've been chasing for a while, but it's been a hard man pinned down. It's not like we don't have a contact for him because he's right here in the office. Our colleague, Letterboxd's one and only Aaron Yap.
Hello, Gemma and Slim.
If you follow any of our social media accounts, Aaron is the genius who runs the team, who do the tweets and the grams and the unboxings. He's a longtime film writer and movie marketing man. And for the longest time, he worked for the New Zealand version of Netflix, Fatso RIP. But now he's ours. Aaron has a legendary physical media collection and a mind like a trap when it comes to movies. His four favorites reflect his eclectic taste, and they are The Brainiac, Footprints, Local Hero, and Z Channel, A Magnificent Obsession. Aaron, welcome to The Letterboxd Show.
Hey, Gemma. Hey, Slim. I'm glad I got this timing right this time. Sorry for speaking a bit early.
It's not weird at all doing this, is it?
No. I think the only sort of disconnect is actually being having listened to the show for a long time now. It's just being within the space of, you know, in the podcast. So it's kind of an out of body kind of feeling for me. Very happy to be here. And yeah, interesting process of being able to talk about your favorite movies in this way.
I remember we were in a meeting together maybe like a month ago. And I think it was at the end of the week. And Aaron had said as like a sign off, yeah, I need to go get ready for my Letterboxd show appearance. And in my head, I was like, oh my God, that's like a month away, Aaron.
Yeah.
Aaron, please. The prep work started so far in advance. It was impressive. Maybe the most of any of our guests in history.
Yeah, I'm hoping to deliver on that, and I'm taking this seriously. So my memory recall isn't that great as well. So prep is definitely helpful, and yeah, thanks for all the notes.
Whose memory recall is great 3 years into a pandemic? Honestly,
that's true. Yeah,
it's just gotten
worse. It doesn't exist.
Brain fog.
Speaking of exhaustive, so my understand as preparation for this show, you did exhaustive research into our guest.
I did. You know, I have a team, you know, in Philadelphia that helps me with this research team. And I had no idea, Aaron, that you were a New Zealand critic. So I think it's learning experience, not just for me, but our audience as well. So Aaron obviously heads up the social team, but I had no idea that in addition to the various hats that you wear at Letterboxd, you know, writing, social team, and so many other things, but you were also like a legit New Zealand film critic. And is there anything you miss from that? Or do you appreciate now the kind of grassroots, as Gemma has called it over the years, the grassroots Letterboxd style of watching, writing, and loving movies?
Yeah, so I guess writing about movies professionally was almost my first proper job. So I always have the work element of writing attached to it. And it's a double-edged sword, as Gemma, you probably know that combining your love for film and then having to pump out words for work is sometimes quite challenging. And doing it all, you know, in a consistent way and delivering is difficult, but can be rewarding as well. But yeah, I do appreciate Letterboxd's looser style. I don't write as much as I used to now, and precisely because it does have a kind of work stigma attached to it. I prefer just to like enjoy things and log my movies. And when I get time, a little bit of writing is great. I still like to do it. So, but it's a really great training ground for anyone who wants to, you know, be write professionally, to kind of see both sides of the industry as a fan and also somewhat like the behind the scenes stuff as well.
I think I did film criticism for a major magazine in New Zealand for about a year and a half, and then I was done. I was out. I couldn't handle the pressure. The thing is, as Aaron well knows, New Zealand is a really small country, and in fact, you once wrote about the dangers of being a film critic in a small country, about how we're all related, or at least very, very likely to bump into the filmmaker whose movie we've just reviewed as decidedly average. And that happened, right?
Yeah, it's quite difficult in that sense that you have, everyone knows someone. It's not, you know, you don't have too many degrees of separation before you hit someone who's read your review. And I've had instances over the years where it's become slightly personal. You know, I know I've learned one of Gemma, my mutuals, have had a, you know, I don't know if I want to bring it up at this stage, but it was an interesting period.
Oh, no, we'll put the link in the notes. Yeah, people can read about it. But you don't have to re-traumatize yourself here.
It's funny, the first film we're going to talk about, I'll bring some of that in because it's all related. I mean, it's a small country, being a film writer, talking about movies and rating them, is not everyone's going to be happy with what you write.
The good news is, The Rock can't blacklist me from Letterboxd for my 2-star Black Adam review or my 1-star Red review. He can't hurt me on Letterboxd. He can't do it.
Yeah, you can't be blacklisted on Letterboxd for your opinions unless they contravene our community policy.
Oh,
in which
yeah,
case, you're a dick anyway. So
you got bigger things to worry about than what The Rock will think.
I love your writing, Aaron. I'm sad that you're so busy that you don't write enough for us. You wrote a brilliant piece on Elam Klimov's Come and See when it elevated itself up into the top three, and it's now the highest rated film on Letterboxd. I highly recommend people read that. But in the piece you wrote about bumping into the filmmaker whose film you'd reviewed not well, you wrote, to read a critic who's able to provide discourse, provide context, and inspire new perspective with is an intrinsic, vital part of living and breathing the culture.
Did I write that? Yeah. As for memory recall, I can't believe I wrote that. But that's a good reminder. I mean, yeah, Letterboxd is a kind of a positive platform for having that sort of connection with the filmmaker who can just reach out and read about their work. I think that's a good thing. I hope it inspires more of those kind of new perspectives, especially at that grassroots level.
Mm. Who took you to your first movie in a cinema?
Probably my dad. I've always, he was the one that always took me and my brother to movies. I don't remember I can't remember what the earliest film I saw, but stuff on definitely home viewings are quite memorable, just like going to the video store. And this was back in Malaysia, where we don't have video stores in the sense of like Blockbuster or, you know, Video Easy when it used to be around in New Zealand. I'll just come out and say they were essentially pirated stores. I think Isabel Sandoval posted a great picture of I think it was yesterday, there was this great picture of the stall which just pirated DVDs. And that's essentially, Southeast Asia is kind of like that. That's the way people consume movies in that time. And yeah, saw lots of crazy shit. And they weren't censored. I think one of my favorite memories was watching like The Beast Within. It's like this early 80s horror film that kind of traumatized me for quite a long time when I was probably 10. I sort of was watching, peeking over my dad's shoulder, and there was one scene where the monster in the film is, the character's transforming slowly into the monster, and it was done in that sort of graphic detail where I could actually feel it happening to me as well. So I thought for a while something was changing within my body, that was similar to the way the character was transforming. But that's kind of a memory that always stays with me.
We were talking earlier about physical collections in the introductions, and I've been known to poke fun at your physical media collection along with Mitchell's. And recently I was asked what a movie was that solidified my love of film or just movie watching. And to me, it was my earliest memories of buying a DVD player and a DVD. Mm. So when I first bought a DVD player, it was like a GE, And I guess it was around the time frame of Contact and Austin Powers. Those were my formative memories. And like plugging in this to the TV and showing my dad that, like, look at the picture quality of this DVD. Like, this is blowing your VHSs away. And I also remember plugging in the cables to the VCR, which was connected to the TV, and they had like this auto piracy protection enabled, so it would like fade the picture in and out because it thought I was trying to record the DVDs. But do you have that memory with a physical purchase, you know, and one of your earliest physical purchases that maybe you wish you still had, or maybe still do have, that created that relationship for you?
Yes, definitely. I do. The way I organize from the first DVDs I bought, they're in chronological order. And after, I think, maybe the last few years, this has spiraled out of control. But the first maybe 50 to 100, they're still stacked in the order that I bought them.
Wow.
So the first DVD I ever bought was Night of the Living Dead, the Elite Entertainment version. It's got an awful cover. And it's still the first DVD on the shelf that I first used to put all my DVDs in.
Wow.
And that was probably the earliest memory of buying something, a disc anyway, physically. And then I think it might have been a Criterion DVD after that. Maybe like High and Low, which Gemma picked out a Blu-ray upgrade for me from the closet. Thank you. those couple of films. It was Criterion was definitely an early kind of awareness. Okay, there's a canon here that I need to, you know, dig into and just watch everything they have.
Gemma, do you remember your earliest physical purchase memory?
Earliest physical purchase
of a movie?
Oof. Yeah. It would have been like a 5-pack of blank VHSs so that I could tape movies off the TV and pause every time the ad break came on. My siblings and I would, we'd have to rock, paper, scissors for who was going to sit up late with their finger on the pause record button.
Oh my God.
To block out the commercials so that we could all then sit down and watch this movie later. First DVD purchase, The Departed. Martin Scorsese's Departed. I loved that movie so much that I knew I was going to buy it the instant it became available. Never watched it since.
Does that make your top 250 still, The Departed? Is that still in your top 250 or no?
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember the cases for the DVDs used to have like snapper, like lids. And one of the first ones I bought in that style was Taxi Driver, Scorsese one. Mm. And yeah, I've never upgraded it, but I do miss those plastic, the sound. It's one of those obsolete sounds you'll never hear again when you open the snapper.
Yeah.
Speaking of crazy shit and men transforming into strange beasts, shall we dive into your first favorite? El Baron del Terror, or in English, The Brainiac, 1962, Chano Urueta. This has a whopping 2.7 average out of 5 stars on Letterboxd. So we're coming in hard. We're coming in hard with the 2.7 horror. I have to say, watching this, I was like, ha, 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 thank you, Aaron. In 1661 Mexico, the Baron Vitellius of Astara is sentenced to be burned alive by the Holy Inquisition for witchcraft, necromancy, and various other crimes. And as he dies, he swears vengeance against the descendants of his inquisitors. Cut to 300 years later, and a comet lands in Mexico, bringing with it the Baron in the form of a horrible brain-eating monster who is about to terrorize the inquisitors' descendants. What a gift. What a gift to cinema and what a gift to the Letterboxd show.
Yeah, just having you read out the synopsis. Thanks, by the way, because I was just telling Slim that synopsizing a movie is not my strongest points. And having that read out to me, which I've never heard before, makes it sound even more insane. It probably is insane in that sense. I thought I'd throw a curveball for the first pick and start off with something that I don't know if anyone... Has anyone picked? Is this the strangest movie that I don't know?
It might be. It might be.
Three other people have this in their favorites on Letterboxd. We have had a movie that nobody had in their favorites. So it's still not the most obscure film. Sorry, Aaron, you have to try
it
harder
might
next
be,
time.
But it might be the strangest. It might be this, one of the strangest we've ever had, for sure.
I actually rewatched this about a year ago. I had a DVD of it, which had the original Spanish language soundtrack to it. And I thought I'd rewatch it because I'd never seen it in the original language. And it plays, I mean, it's still a crazy movie, but it's, you know, it's quite nice to hear the Spanish-speaking soundtrack. And when I logged in on Letterboxd, I was really surprised to see how low it was. For some reason, I thought maybe it was a film that people would have embraced for how absurd and like crazy and off the wall it is. But it seems like a very kind of, you either love it or totally hate it, or, you know, I don't know.
For anyone who's hesitating, this guy, well, first of all, the Inquisition scene is long and quite insane. And he has this epic line, "If my body is to be burned, it will be without chains." And then he disappears. The chains just disappear. And this is like 1962. I'm freaking out about the practical effects. Mm-hmm. And then he comes back as this aforementioned brainiac, and he's got... I don't know if I can describe the tongue.
One of the funniest things about the film is that cut from the Inquisition scene straight to the present day. It's like the swanky jazz club right after this long-ass Inquisition, and he's like tortured and being burned and stuff. And it does the swinging scene right after it. I love that transition. But yeah, the monster, how do you even... I was trying to describe it in my notes. Like, how do you even describe this thing to someone who's never seen it? Like, what does it look like?
And it's like, it looks like a pulsating rat face. Like, it is pulsating for some reason. He, like, can warp into this monster with a gigantic tongue. Looks like a fruit roll-up that's frozen in an extended form. And but his cheeks
prongs,
are like...
a two-pronged tongue. Yeah, right.
But his cheeks are going like in and out, in and out. Oh my God, it was very unsettling. And we should point out too that related to the lower rating, Jack did put some facts together. It's the second lowest rated film we've covered behind Ang Lee's The Hulk.
Oh, wow.
Ang Lee The Hulk was rated lower. What? Oh my God, I couldn't believe it.
That's interesting. Yeah.
I know. I feel like history should be kinder to Ang Lee's The Hulk.
It turns up on a lot of Letterboxd lists about psychotronic cinema, and I'd love you to take a moment to explain psychotronic to the listeners, i.e. me, who aren't quite across this genre.
Maybe not a specific genre as such, because I guess psychotronic might cover a lot of different genres within that sort of umbrella, whether it's sci-fi, horror, or, you know, just thrillers and stuff. But yeah, just... crazy shit out of norm, you know. When I first saw Brainiac, it was at a 24-hour movie marathon that was in a sort of this one-screen cinema called the Chinatown. Gemma, I don't know if you've ever been there, but they used to have the Incredibly Strange Film Festival there. And one, because the 24-hour movie marathon is an annual thing, but for this, for whatever reason, this year, they just had a 12-hour one. And they played the Brainiac on 16mm, and it came at probably 4 a.m. in the morning. And, you know, everyone's just, you know, dying at that stage, even though it's 12 hours, not 24 hours. But it was kind of the perfect time to see that movie. And the print was kind of muddy, and you're bleary eyed and just trying to take everything in. And you see this monster. And I think it's kind of a perfect kind of psychotronic time to like consume this kind of stuff. So I think about that, just very strange and out of the ordinary, off the wall kind of sensibilities.
First of all, I can't even think about watching a movie at 4 a.m. in a theater. I would be dead. I would be crawling out of there into my car to get into my bed, even for a 12-hour movie marathon. I don't know how people do it. I was thinking to Gemma's earlier comment about how he didn't want to be burned in the chains. So the chains disappear, but he still goes to get burned. He's like, like you just made chains disappear off your body. Maybe just like fly out the window so that you can continue to live.
Yeah.
I thought that was hilarious. And then he gets burned for the next 10 or 15 minutes while he curses the family of descendants. These are the main things that jumped out at me were like this entire movie is this witch wizard enacting revenge on the descendants of those, you know, the Inquisitors. Mm. But they could be nice people. You know, how many generations have gone down the line? He's still going to annihilate them, and that's the movie. Yeah.
And by the way, he was burned because he was evil. to start right. with. But the Letterboxd reviews of this are hilarious. I mean, I think you've, you know, definitely found your people here, Aaron. Amy Voorhees writes, I find the Letterboxd average star rating for this movie disturbingly low. The Baron seduces women and eats brains. What more do you people want? Anyone who rates this movie lower than 3 stars has abdicated joy.
Slim was just mentioning all these little moments that just kind of, I don't know, logically, they just don't make sense at all. And just, you know, the flamethrower, like he can walk through people. He's like, he goes through walls and stuff. And but a flamethrower will just stop him. Spoilers, but
right.
it doesn't take away the prepared for how big those flamethrowers are.
They're huge. There's this moment where he's like in his castle or manor or whatever with some people, and he just casually decides that he needs a little bit more of a snack. So he walks over to this locked cabinet and opens it up, and there's a silver bowl full of brains, and he gets a spoon.
Oh my God.
Puts the spoon in the brains and kind of like tastes the brains like he's just checking the stew to see if there's enough salt or if it needs more salt. Like, he's just so casual about it.
Love that it's scene, so those scenes. I think that the thing that makes this movie work so well is it's played quite straight. Like, other than there's a little bit of comic relief from the detectives they seem to be so far ahead of the investigation, they're just always playing catch up. There's some comic mm-hmm. stuff happening there that is kind of, you know, you can see they're trying to get laughs, but for the most of it, like the Baron and the monster, they're just kind of, it's just, you know, it is what it is. It's quite straight. It's not like, you know, they're quite sincere about the how they present the monster and what he's doing and everything.
There is a lot that horror writers of today could learn about how to instill fear in a scene though, because even though it's sort of comically bad, one of the things that the Brainiac does is he'll be in a room with a man and a woman and he will stare at the man, like basically hypnotize the man till he's frozen on the spot. He can't move, but he can see exactly what's going on. And then he pulls out that double-pronged tongue and starts like making out with the lady. And then the tongue comes around and stabs her in the back of the neck while this poor hypnotized man is watching on. I mean, this is just terrifying to describe.
It's disturbing.
When you drill it down like that, it does seem it's so unsettling. One of the things I wanted to mention was the kind of the cheapness of it. Like, I find that really endearing. I feel like it's the, I described in my review, it's like kind of the detour of monster movies. The way, you know, all the kind of threadbare and impoverished optical effects, they still have a lot of charm for me. I mean, even if you see like a shitty matte painting or just wallpaper of I think it's the observatory or like the backdrop to the city, it just looks super tacked on a flat.
Yeah.
I feel like there's so much room for being able to like make that real for yourself, for this film, for me anyway. Like I don't think it's, well, that's a shitty effect. You know, I'm just totally charmed by the fact that they pulled this off, you know, with what they had.
Well, it was funny. I logged this movie, and in the Discord that I'm in, someone had noted that they had just seen this movie at like one of those thrift like bins, you know, like the $5 movies. And it made like such a connection for me that I have seen probably the same kinds of movies for years in those bins. And I never thought to actually watch them because you see them and you just gloss over them like, oh, the Brainiac, what the heck is that? Never heard of this, 60s. But I'm just so glad that I actually sat to watch one of those movies, because you get a different vibe. You get a completely different vibe from a 60s movies that maybe you're used to. You know, you're watching like Hitchcock or whatever, but you're opening up your mind a little bit with a two-pronged tongue, and that's all it takes.
Exactly.
I was trying to work out if there was anything that connected all four of your faves, and I landed on something that connects two of them specifically, if I may elegantly segue to another film here. The Brainiac is not the only film in your four faves to feature a man who has an observatory in his office and is obsessed with finding a comet. Did you notice that?
Actually, yeah, I did. After rewatching all the four films, I did find I did spot certain trends that present, maybe subconsciously kind of fascinated by, or I don't know what it is, but yeah, definitely in the process of doing this, I did pick up some of those connections.
Ooh, what did you learn about your psyche in the process?
If we want to segue into footprints, there's a clear, and then a local hero as well. For me, Brainiac and Footprints has a sort of connection to like my formative years of discovering this sort of cinema. There's a real mystique about these movies because they were quite difficult to see at one stage. Like, you'd have to hunt them down very... you got to know where to look for them. And Footprints is one that I first read on a forum called Mobius Home Video Forum. I don't know if anyone out there still remembers that little dingy forum, but someone wrote a review of it, and it was like a cut of the US version of the movie on VHS called Primal Impulse.
Whoa.
The artwork is out of this world. I love the artwork of the footprints with like the eyes looking at, peering out, and the guy being stabbed in the bottom of the the poster. But that review stuck with me so much that I did go out of my way to look for the film, which wasn't available in any sort of ready state at that time. And I don't know if the VHS trading period is familiar with you. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but there used to be like these outfits they're called gray market outfits, and you would just like, they would just send you copies of tapes that weren't, of movies that weren't available in the US, and they kind of circumvented the kind of the copyright loopholes under this thing called the Berne Convention. So if something was sort of in the public domain, or supposedly in that sort of space, they could make copies of it and sell them. Actually, Kayla Janice posted something on her Instagram yesterday about European trash cinema, and that was one of the outfits that I did. I did sort of seek out, and it might have even be where I got my first copy of Footprints, actually. But there were a lot of those outfits around, which that was the only way you could watch these movies. And when I first read about them, it was like, instantly, God, I need to see this. And you'd pay like 30, you know, up to 30 bucks just for like a VHS copy of these films, you know, and they would look like shit.
. 1975, directed by Luigi Bezzoni and Mario Finelli, 3.5 average. A woman called Alice finds the real world slowly merging with her recurring nightmares as she tries to solve the puzzle of her recent memory loss and whether her dream of an astronaut abandoned on the moon has anything to do with her identity confusion. Kayla did talk about this. I think this was this included in her box set?
Yes, the Severin Films box set of House of Psychotic Women.
Yes.
Which I ordered it like in October, and I was hoping to have it in my hands to watch it for this show, and then the package is lost somewhere.
Oh my God. UPS drop. New Zealand parcel UPS truck, probably. We had to uncover our own footprints on the moon to figure out where this package is, probably. This movie, I just have to say, what a very strange and dreamy movie. I saw a note from Gemma about how she's still working to figure out the meaning of the film and maybe even the ending. But this was the first time I saw this. I thought it was gorgeous. This movie is stunning, I feel like. And all the cityscapes, the cinematography. But I can't remember a recent movie that I've watched that has left me wondering what the hell I just saw at the end of the movie. And I do have to quietly mention that the version on Tubi ends maybe 20 minutes too soon. Oh. And it ended and I was like, wait a minute, is that the real ending? So then I had to go on Wikipedia, and then I accidentally read the next paragraph and I read my own ending. But I eventually did find it and watch it. It's on YouTube, by the way, for anyone wants to watch it.
That's where I watched it.
So what did you think of this movie, Gemma?
I wrote down, is this one long, sexy commercial for sunglasses? It's definitely one of those movies. And I would put Mulholland Drive in the same camp. Oh. Films that my eyeballs loved watching, but that my brain just has this is not a criticism, my brain has no way to access what the hell I've just seen. And I always often wonder, is that because the filmmakers themselves didn't know? They were just like making a movie with some friends like over 10 days and didn't have time to finish the script? Or is it because they know something I don't, and maybe I need mushrooms or some other way to access a higher plane within which to watch this film? So Aaron, I'm really interested to hear that you've been dreaming about a film that itself is like a fever dream that also has nightmares within it.
Yes, I think I'm very predisposed to loving dreamlike movies. I love movies that play out like dreams and aren't very plot focused, and mood, tone, atmosphere, that's all kind of my catnip for me. And I think Footprints is one of the most elegantly constructed puzzles I've ever seen. It is, I think the first time you see it, it is quite chilly and kind of cold. And you kind of, like you say, it's quite difficult to access it in an emotional way. But I've seen it a few times over the years now. It's gotten way more, I feel like there's a lot of melancholy and there's a lot of yearning in the film, like for a lost time or a memory that you're trying to get back to, but you can't for whatever reason. And the first scene in the film, the first shot actually, you see the moon and the titles come up, and I think it's Nicola Piovani, the composer, it's one of just this stunning score. And when the music comes up and you see that moon, for some reason that shot is just so it's like one of the loneliest shots I've ever felt watching a movie. This is kind of like you don't know where you are, and like you don't know how to get back to where you're supposed to be or whatever. And I think the film plays with that dynamic really well, with the way Florinda Balkan's character can't remember what she's done, and but she remembers when she goes back to this place, it holds some sort of significance to her past, or something she's done. And actually, now processing it, that sort of sense of displacement is related to the next film as well. That you're not feeling at home might be kind of a way to describe it, and you're sort of caught between kind of two worlds or two kind of psyches. You don't know where your brain is at. I love the obviously the locations in Turkey are just stunning, and I love travelogue kind of movies where someone's just walking around and just absorbing everything around them. The architecture is very otherworldly. So anything, that stuff just kind of gets under my skin, because I would love to go to do the same thing Alice does, just kind of walking around. And it's Vulture di Kemer, I think that's the location in Turkey, super haunting, and a portrait of someone struggling with a breakdown or something as well. I mean, it's got so many layers, it just depends how you want to read it.
What I love about Letterboxd is that you can have this experience with a movie because someone like Aaron made you watch it and go, I don't know what I think, but I know that I saw something special, and then find your people. Find the people who saw something similar, if not the same. Sylvie J writes that Footprints is a non-professional mystery, by which I mean a mystery where the protagonist doesn't do the snooping for a living. There's no emotional detachment, and every clue is treated like a holy object, a figurative rosary, a tattered fragment, a wooden cross, all leading to your personal God. Reveals barely mean anything to me these days. The clues and the practice hold the true value.
That's a beautiful review. I couldn't have even put that into words, but I think that captures a lot of what the film feels like to me and what it means like to me. But the meaning may not be as important. And I should mention that it's also it's considered like a giallo adjacent movie, where it contains some of those giallo themes, but it doesn't have the the black glove killer that's chasing someone, and it's marketed like the poster and everything, but the kind of glimpses of trauma, kind of the repressed memories and all that kind of stuff always plays into Gialli. And
that was the one other thing I noticed in all the Letterboxd reviews. Everyone's basically arguing about, as Matt Winfield writes, definitely not the giallo I was expecting. A lot of people talked about that, but Wraith Ape reckons Footprints on the Moon is neither a giallo nor a horror, nor even a thriller, really. More a kind of vaguely surreal mystery comes psychodrama, which unpacks its dreamlike context at a glacial pace. the washed out palette and occasional lapses into unsubtitled Italian dialogue seeming to intensify the mood of uneasy somnolence. You see what I mean? Our people are on Letterboxd.
Those reviews are great. I think they definitely get into that that zone of what Footprints is for people who love it.
I'm just glad Gemma read that review so I don't have to say somnolence and sound that out, because I've never said that word out loud before in my life.
I'm here sort of thinking, I do know what somnolence means, but I don't actually.
Well, much like Footprints itself for me.
Right, that's right. That was a planted review to get us in a dreamlike psycho state.
Speaking of dreamlike psycho states, have either of you ever seen the Northern Lights?
No. Nope.
Me neither.
Nope.
I want to. I so want to. And especially after Local Hero, I'm jonesing for some of that northern Scottish sky. I just want to be there today. Shall we dive in?
Let's get into it.
This is the, because we got to dive in, because I'm going to dive in with my own review. 5 stars, a heart, and the words, Aaron knew I would love this.
Oh, wow. I'm glad the connection between Footprints and Local Heroes is, after seeing it, is this kind of very, there's a close, it could be kind of superficial, but there is something there about being in that place and time and not being in the where you should be. But it's also a place that resonates so much.
So this is from the great Bill Forsyth, Scottish director, written and directed by 1983, 3.8 average, slim. I'm going to ask you to read the very slim synopsis.
An American oil company sends a man to Scotland to buy up an entire village where they want to build a refinery, but things don't go as expected. I love that, but things don't go as expected. You can put that behind 80% of movie synopses and it would make sense. Yep. I feel like, did you put that there, Gemma, or was that already there?
I didn't put that there.
Oh, my God.
Maybe okay. I did. I don't know.
Jack calls out the Jack's facts. This was the last film I watched before lockdown in 2020, so it was a nice breath of fresh air. And I, to be perfectly frank, I had not heard of this movie, but in researching the film, this is a beloved movie, I feel like, among the Letterboxd faithful. There's something about this movie that connects them.
Yeah, I was surprised this was more beloved than Gregory's Girl, which was one of the great Scottish movies. It's the Scottish coming-of-age film for any young Scottish man. But Local Hero sits head and shoulders above. And as you say, Slim, it's not just on a lot of Letterboxd favourites. It's in Edgar Wright's 1,000 favourite movies. It's in the Safdie brothers' favourite films. Taika Waititi mentions it, which I actually, when I was watching it, I was like, huh, I wonder if he got the idea for the bit in his film Boy where the Rachel House's character has all the jobs in the village from Local Hero, and then found out that this is one of his favourite films. So there it is. This is a massive favourite, and almost wasn't made. David Putnam, who is a legendary producer, approached his regular backers, Warner Brothers and Goldcrest Films, to fund it, and they were like, no. Then he won a BAFTA for Chariots of Fire in 1982, and they agreed.
I'm so happy that you love this film, I think. And as Slim mentioned, that it's one of those, it's a strange film in the sense that, like, still a lot of people don't know it exists, but it carries so much weight with the people who love it. And it's obviously in the Criterion Collection now, so it's, you know, it's got that stature. But it's the same thing when I first discovered it. Like bargain bin DVD stalls, like I see this, it kind of looks like a generic film when you look titled Local Hero, and then you see like Burt Lancaster and Peter Reagan on the cover, just this two guys and like, you know, the pants rolled up and they're standing in water. It doesn't jump out at you as like a movie you want to see immediately. And so like, if you recommend that someone to watch this DVD, they will probably not watch it immediately. They all just leave it on the shelves for like months.
Right. And the thing is that, you know, films change as life changes. And my pitch to someone listening would be, if you love Peter Capaldi as any one of the following, Malcolm Tucker from The Thick of It, Doctor Who, or Mr. Curry from the Paddington movies, then watch Local Hero for a very, very, very young Peter Capaldi, falling in love with an extremely hot Jenny Seagrove who has webbed feet. None of that is on the poster.
And then the Criterion poster, the cover for the album, Blu-ray, it takes a more kind of magic realist approach. But I still feel like it's not at the end of that scale, that spectrum. It's got that very, very kind of sublime balance of a little bit of, you know, magic, but it's also quite super low key. I just love how relaxed it is about everything it does. And the performances. Anyone who's like looking at this and going, this is not a movie for me, it's definitely give it a go. Local Hero. It's one of the most, it's a lot of people say it's really special. It's got that special feeling about it, and
yeah,
very restorative. Every time I watch it, it's just like, it puts me into another kind of a state where you're like, you know, you're feeling at peace. It's so wistful. Mark Knopfler's score is just heavenly. Ugh. And the comedy, I'm not a huge comedy kind of person, but I just love Forsyth's gentle, it's not laugh out loud. It's got just little moments that you know you're just kind of like smiling at, and that's enough for me. I think that's you know, like the scene where they're in the restaurant, they're having breakfast or something, and they take out, they're trying to squeeze a lemon, and it just like pops in their eye, like, and Peter Mac does it as well, and that sort of stuff is so funny, even though it's not like cripplingly, you know, laugh out loud.
One of the reasons I think that works, so cinema is full of movies about Americans going to small towns in other people's countries, and the wacky culture clash that plays out as a result of that. This could have been that, and for so many reasons it's not. And I think one of the reasons is because Peter Capaldi is with the Pickle Man, our friend Peter Reigert from Crossing Delancey. So the two Peters, one of them is from Aberdeen. So he's also from the big city, but he's Scottish. And then the other is American. And it's that pairing of the two of them, I think, that works. If it had just been Peter Reigert's character, McIntyre, it would have potentially fallen into that cheesy, corny, let's see how an American does in a little Scottish seaside village.
It could have been Michael Douglas in that role.
Oh,
it could
God.
Have been Michael Douglas.
Wait,
I read
what?
That it
Wait.
Was almost Michael Douglas. Can you imagine
really?
Him in a suit in this movie coming to grips with working as an oil company man?
Imagine Michael Douglas in that role.
I know, right? It would have been amazing.
Yeah.
No. No, Slim, I'm sorry.
Yes.
You can't have it all.
I'm pro Michael Douglas in this role in a suit. Everyone needs to know that.
I love that it's Peter Reigert, and I love that, you know, he's a Jewish man whose descendants are from Hungary, whose parents, as he explains, chose the name McIntyre because they thought it sounded American. And so he gets mistaken for Scottish. So Burt Lancaster sends him, because he's got a Scottish sounding surname, to try and buy up this beach. And the thing about Mac is, back in Houston, Texas, where the Knox gas company is based, he's kind of a loser. You know, he calls up his workmate to see if she'll go for drinks with him because he's leaving the next day. And she's like, no. He calls up an ex to tell her to come pick up his stuff, and he's not trying to get into a fight. They get into a fight. I like how it's sort of set up, not as if he's a busy man who just needs to escape to the beach to kind of reconnect with what's real. He's actually a little bit of a sad dick.
Yeah, and the title here, it's sort of like the title is almost like a misnomer in the sense that who is the hero of this film? Like, there's, you know, like, obviously Mac's not a traditional kind of hero, or if he is at all. And I like the fact that, you know, just the townsfolk are very, they want the money. They just kind of like, happy to like, you know, haggle and just kind of get the most out of the, you know, the oil company. And there's no like, there's so little conflict in the film, and I think this sort of film makes me realize that conflict can be a little bit overrated. You don't need like confrontations at every angle, like these massive plot beats to reach. And I think Forsyth does that so well in this film. Just let it flow. It's kind of just an easy, it's like a, you know, stream. You know?
Wes left a review: cinema for the soul. You can smell the sea, taste the whiskey, Feel the breeze on your face. Approach this with a clear mind and let it gently wash over you like the tides lapping against the shore, and you'll realize there's a quiet, charming comfort to be found. Once you find it, you'll never want to leave.
Can we talk about the cinematography? Because the sky, the sunsets, the sunrises are so much a part of this film. And to the extent that Mac has to stand in a phone booth, the only phone in the village, and call Burt Lancaster back in Houston, Texas to describe the sky to him.
Yes.
Sir, I'll give you the colors first, sir. It's white and green and red. I'm sorry, that's the phone box. Oh, it's blue. It just blew. It's like a shower of color.
Tell him it's the Aurora Borealis.
I have some more information, sir. It's the Aurora Borealis. But it's beautiful.
Ah, you're a lucky man, McIntyre. I haven't seen the Aurora since 53 in Alaska.
And while he's describing it, we are seeing it, and it's capturing the Northern Lights, capturing a meteor shower, capturing any kind of planetary landscape on film is tricky, because these are not special effects. This is just time and a lens.
Yes, beautiful. Chris Mingus just shot the hell out of this film, and not flashy at all, just painting with the light that he has in that sort of region. I think it just hits so something soft about the whole, you know, it's not harsh to look at. The phone booth, the red phone booth against the sky at night, I don't know, all that stuff is just out of this world.
Yeah. Your next movie on your list, I think, probably would have helped the circulation of this movie, Z Channel, Magnificent Obsession, 2004, directed by Zan Cassavetes, 3.7 average. So this is a documentary on the Z Channel, one of the first pay cable stations in the U.S., and its programming chief, Jerry Harvey. Debuting in 1974, the L.A.-based channel's eclectic slate of movies become a prime example on the untapped power of cable television. And this kind of catalogs the history of this channel, which brought to light so many movies that I know of now as kind of like classics, but at the time were not so. And this channel started playing these movies. He worked with the directors to get, you know, the director's cut of films to play them, like McCabe and Mrs. Miller was one, Heaven's Gate. So how did you come to find this documentary? And did you know about this channel earlier before seeing it?
No, absolutely not. I never heard of Z Channel until I saw this documentary. I think I first saw this maybe on DVD or screener, because it played at a local film festival, but I don't ever recall seeing the documentary in a theater setting, so it must have been at home in some way. This is the only film on my four face that I hadn't seen in probably over 10 years, so it's very fresh in my sort of fresh rewatch. The first time I watched it, I was completely blown away just by the what, you know, Jerry did with the channel. And film programming has always been like a dream job of mine, and the whole curatorial, his genius in programming these films together in this way was really inspiring to watch. And also, especially as I feel like it's a great letterbox type movie, you know, there's so many movies in there. You watch it and, God, I need to make lists. I got to go through all these movies and watch them. Yeah.
It's exactly what I wrote in my review of the film was, imagine seeing this film when it came out in 2004 and not having Letterboxd to pound that watch list button with every film mentioned. Mm. You'd just be sitting there with a notebook, with a pencil and paper going, yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
I mean, he had to have had such an encyclopedic knowledge to even program a network by that point. I was like trying to do the math in my head. I was like, when is he watching these movies? Mm. To discover them and then add them to the listing of the channel. There's a few screenshots of like almost like the TV guide aspect of the movies that were playing that week on the channel. I saw a Creepshow in there at one point. So I'm fascinated as to like the programming nature of that, because it's a lot of work to have so many winners and then fill out the channel.
Something the film does leave out is that sort of the actual nitty gritty of how you actually go about programming. There's a great shot of the this wall with the calendar. I always look at that and go, this is so exciting. From January to February, you know, these are the movies we're going to plot and, you know, going to play it. But yeah, just the wealth of imagine watching this and discovering just so many, so much out there beyond the norm, and being able to share that with such a wide audience, you know, just, and that's everyone trusts your tastes almost. And it's not, you know, these days you get, you know, the algorithm chooses for you, and there's very little, you know, well, I wouldn't say there's very little, but, you know, outfits like Criterion Channel or MUBI or even, you know, physical media, Vinegar Syndrome, yeah.
There's a review that speaks to that somewhat. Sex Racebex writes, unlike many talking head docs that are a glorified string of reaction videos and ass kissing, Z Channel offered actual insight into its subject. For example, one director describing the importance of what a film hides from its audience, or the appeal and social importance of softcore programming. And in some ways, it helped me imagine a kind of retro future for streaming if it was targeted toward the smartest fans rather than the lowest common denominator.
Mm. Yeah, that was an interesting aspect of the documentary where one of those closely involved in the process, like later in the film, they're like, oh yeah, and at night, our late night programming was like one of our most popular softcore porn movies. And that like
the
helped
the Night Owl films.
The Night Owl,
oh my
yes.
Gosh.
That was so cool to see them like really get, like, I would love another documentary from them just to get into the business nitty gritty. They said they had 100,000 subscribers for this channel at the time. Like, oh my God, that's so many subscribers for this, like, you know, film. They even called it, one of them called it like a film festival in your house every night, which I hear people and even MUBI like describe their service that way. And I've been thinking about this topic a lot over the last couple of months. My friend Chuck bought one of those like Game Boy, not like an emulator, but it's like the hardware of a Game Boy, and you could play the actual Game Boy games in the back. And there are so many products out today that have like thousands of games on them, or even thousands of movies. And like, you can't decide what to do because you play a game for 5 minutes. You're like, oh, well, I'll try something else. I got like 1,000 other to try. But when it's just that one thing, you're almost like forced to focus and enjoy it. And this channel like reminded me of that. Like, they had so much programming on there. Like, Once Upon a Time in America, they had that long dive on, but how it ended up, you know, floundering in the edit. And they're showing the uncut version. And man, what a time. We have to go back, Aaron. We have to go back to just this one channel, and they force you to sit down and watch these things.
We definitely have to go back.
We should note for the audience that with obsession comes trouble, and that Jerry's life and the life of his partner did not end well. And correct. That is raised right at the start of the film so that it's not like dropped on you like a bomb near the end. And all I would say about that is, call your friends, normalize therapy. Mm-hmm. Must be noted. But you're so right. Imagine living in a time when you're screening a legendary film and the filmmaker, Sam Peckinpah, shows up with the reel. You know, it's not, you're not just kind of downloading a file from some anonymous right. Google Drive.
Yeah.
There's the filmmaker at the door with the reels.
Yeah, it's just fascinating that he's rubbing shoulders for like Peckinpah, and then also Michael Cimino, you know, just hanging out at this bar and, you know, just getting pissed. And China 9, Liberty 37, he co-wrote that Monty Hellman Western. So this was a guy who was, you know, he was like living and breathing movies, you know, whether he was like programming them or just kind of, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they Zan got Robert Altman for this. I'm like, that's enough for me. Like, you know, having Robert Altman speak and in this documentary was, you know, was wonderful to see.
The last thing I'll say before we wrap, and that could be the ending, but how about that scene where they're going to see the premiere of The Sicilian with Michael Cimino, and they're at the premiere and they had this amazing, look like an amazing Italian poster for The Sicilian, which made it look like the coolest movie ever. Because I've only ever seen the DVD poster. I just changed mine on Letterboxd to the one that I saw. Mm. And then how they even say like, it wasn't that great. But then he showed us the uncut director's version, like the director's cut version privately. And it was an amazing experience. Yeah. Like, man, can you imagine being in that situation, running a channel, hanging out with the director, and then he shows you the uncut director's cut and you'll love it. What a life.
Just so casually, I just saw this, you know, me and Michael just catching this director's cut.
Yes. Amazing.
That was a good place to end, but I'd love to quickly ask, just a very, very, very quick to finish, Aaron, a quick deep dive into your stats. I'm looking at your rated higher than average, and it's just a brilliant crush of 5 stars for wild genre films versus the 1 to 2 stars everyone else gives. But Slim and Aaron, Halloween 2, 2.37 average on Letterboxd. It's 4 stars from Aaron. How does that sit with you, Slim?
You know, believe it or not, I have not seen any of the Rob Zombie Halloweens. I have been scared off of them from the Halloween stands that I have never seen them. But this Aaron rating is making me want to question things.
Yeah, Halloween 2 by Rob Zombie. I wouldn't go out of the way to say I'm a Rob Zombie fan as such. But, you know, the stuff he does, it's interesting. The stuff that I can latch onto there. And I felt Halloween 2 a swing. For the franchise, maybe not so much as Halloween 3. Halloween 3 is probably not a swing as such, but I mean, just the stuff that he poured into it felt like it came from a real place and not just kind of another franchise entry.
What's your rating for Halloween Ends?
I've left that out.
No rating, no heart on Halloween Ends. I see how it is.
I can take away something from Halloween Ends. It's trying something, but it didn't work that great for me in the way that maybe Halloween 2 did.
Cut the mics, Gemma. Pull the plug on this episode. Cut it. It's fine.
I'm ready to end the show because I got to go and have another Local Hero rewatch. It's my gentle cinema happy place now.
Our guest today was our colleague Aaron Yap, and you can enjoy the fruits of his labors on our social media accounts. Thanks to our crew, Jack for the facts, Brian Formo for booking and looking after our guests, Sophie Shin for the episode transcript, Sam for the art, and to Moniker for the theme music.
And to you, Slim,
for
editing the show. We also have another podcast, Weekend Watchlist, featuring Slim, Mitchell, and Mia Vicino. They explore the latest releases in theatres and on streaming and shuffle their watch lists for randomised movie fun. Please consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us to keep the show going. You can always drop us a line at podcast@letterboxd.com. We love mail. The Letterboxd Show is a tape deck production. Calm down, Slim. It's just a meteor shower.
Never seen one in my life.
Oh my God, me neither.
No, I don't see that happening here. I don't see that at all.
Blue mackerel, what's happened?
It's just the northern lights. Aurora Borealis. High energy protons spilling over into our atmosphere. They get through the magnetic shield where it's weak, at the poles.
Oh, that's still beautiful, I don't care what you call it. How often does this happen?
Oh, any old time. Although it's best when the sun's active. That gets the solar wind up, and that's where the protons come from.
You say the darndest things, Marina.
This is a Tape Deck Podcast.